This meeting to order. This is the Wednesday, January 30th, 2013, meeting of the Transportation and Public Safety Finance Division. Today, members, I have some announcements, but I might wait because I guess I need to keep the microphone closer. I understand from our last meeting, so I'll try to do that. When members show up, just so presenters know, I'm going to interrupt at some point to do some housekeeping announcements. Today on the agenda, we have budget overviews. We have the Metropolitan Council. We'll start with them. Chair Haig is here, but the Met Council does meet in session just a little bit. So if we can get Chair Haig through her presentation and on to the Met Council, that would be the best, although she has offered generously to stay here if she needs to. And then we'll bring up Terry Hatch from MnDOT following the Met Council presentation. So with that, welcome to the committee, Mr. Shettinen, Chair Haig.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm happy to be here and look forward to working with this committee as you are putting together your budget. I'm very pleased to be here today to present an overview for the Metropolitan Council's transportation budget. This is the governor's budget, and I think what you'll hear today is that it's consistent with the overall themes in the budget of really trying to make investments that help create jobs and economic opportunity, making sure that our tax system is fair and that it's reformed appropriately, and that we and the government efficiently and effectively. I'm going to really start with saying that transit is, in fact, a part of our thriving metro economy. Transit is really that place that businesses connect to their employees and that workers find jobs and connect to jobs. Transit is extremely important to reduce congestions on our roadways in the metro area, and of course, that helps our businesses get their goods to market and to the consumers. It provides significant environmental benefits for the region, and it really gives choices to consumers and our customers. So one thing that people don't always think about when they think about the region is the role that we play as part of the state's economy. So the Twin Cities metro area is in fact, in a really important for the entire state of Minnesota. Our seven-county metro area gross product is about $200 billion. That actually makes us the 13th largest metropolitan area in the United States, and it is about two-thirds of the state's gross domestic product is produced out of this region. In fact, our metro economy here in the Twin Cities is larger than half of the states in this country. So the economic value of us as a region to the state, I think, is a significant issue. Today, as I talk about our
transit. Mr. Chair?
Senator Wigger.
Thank you. I had a question of Chair Haig. That's very significant, the point you make on the economic impact. And as I recall, a part of that 1967 charge to the council is the orderly economic development of the area. On that charge, do you work with the newly created 11-county with Wisconsin group that is about retaining and recruiting business for this area?
Sure.
Senator Wigger, yes, I serve on the board of Greater MSP, and you're correct that the state law that created the Metropolitan Council really focused on the need for the council to exist to create economic prosperity for the region.
Senator Wigger was himself a Met Council member at one time, so he knows whereof he speaks.
Not Thank in you. 67, but...
Well, as I present this overview of the budget, I just want to throw up this map today, and we'll go into this in more detail. But today, these are really the major transitway connections in the region. You can see the I-35W MinPass lane to the south, the I-394 MinPass lane to the west, The Red Line, which is a new BRT line that is going to connect from Apple Valley up to the Mall of America, and the Blue Line, which is the Hiawatha Light Rail Line. The Green Line that to the east that you're familiar with that is under construction and will open in 2014, and then the Yellow Line on this map is on the North Star Commuter Rail. So that is the system as it is today. And the budget that we are presenting to you today and that the governor has put together really shows you a picture of what we can have in this metro region. We can have development throughout the region, more busways, more LRT lines, more rapid bus, and better and more service for everyone in the region. So the budget proposal today is significant in that it really provides for increases in transit funding for both capital and operating. The governor is recommending a 0.25 cent local sales tax increase for the 7 metro county area to grow our transit system to be able to meet the population growth in the future to begin to alleviate congestion. We need this additional growth. So this proposal would increase the sales tax for a 7-county region by 0.25 cent. Today there is a 0.25 cent that is collected by 5 counties, the CTIB counties, County Transit Improvement Board counties. And with the expansion of the sales tax base in the governor's budget, this amount of money would produce significant new revenue for us. So to be clear, the governor's budget on sales tax would be reduced over the state from 6.875% to 5.5%. This particular component is a 0.25 cent increase on that in the 7 metro county area. So the increase in our transit funding would yield $348 million over the biennium 2014 and 2015. It would not go into effect until January of 2014, so we have a partial year in the first year. So you can see that a portion of this is collected from expanded seats by the broader sales tax base and a portion from the additional 0.25 cent dedicated transit tax. So in the first year, it's about $100 million. In the second year of the biennium, it's about $248 million. So what's important for the Transportation Finance Committee and your budget areas is that this budget proposal really will help to address a state budget shortfall. We have about an $18 million shortfall in the state share of light rail operating costs for this next biennium. It would also fund the state share of bonding for the Southwest LRT capital costs. We need about $118 million to be able to advance that project. It relieves general fund operating costs for both our current transit ways, Hiawatha Light Rail, our BRTs, our Green Line, and for any future transit ways. And importantly, it relieves pressure on the state GO bonds because this would provide a capital source for future transit way development. In 2014 and 2015, because this brings in additional revenue in the first 2 years of the biennium, it's actually budget relieving, so there's a $46.8 million reduction to the state general fund in the transportation budget for Metro Transit from the current base of $130 million. I think what's significant about this proposal and for your consideration, that this really builds out the future transit system for the 21st century. It ends what were a series of one-time fixes in transportation funding, really, for the last decade. We have had about $100 million over the last 8 or 9 years in one-time fixes. And those included shifting property tax to pay for additional transit funding, seeking one-time state appropriations, one-time allocations from CTIB when CTIB was formed, and a variety of actions that were needed to take to try to keep the transit system whole. So in sum, you know, this budget is going to create both a reliable and a sufficient transit funding source to build out this system for the next 20 years. It's going to keep our metro area very competitive with other regions, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. Encourage a lot of private economic investment, and you'll see more information in my presentation about how these transitways actually help to create more opportunity for the market to come in and create economic development. And in addition, this is an easy source to administer and collect, and it grows with the population growth. And as we're building out a transit system, we are really trying to create a system that will reflect the growing population demands in the region. So as you think about, you know, both the operations funding and our tax policy goals overall, one of the themes of the governor's budget really is to, you know, to make sure we have a balanced system. So the current system, you can see that the green is the fares. About 28% of the transit system is today generated by fares. The red comes from the regional system, money collected by the County Transit Improvement Board through the quarter cent sales tax, and the rest comes from the state. A portion of it comes from NVEST and a portion from the state general fund. This proposal the governor has is would create less reliance on the state general fund and state sources in general, would maintain that fare box recovery at 28%. We're really one of the most competitive regions in the country for our fare box recovery, would continue to have the state help with funding for Metro Mobility, which is the transit services for people who have disabilities, and part of both a federal and state mandates for service levels there. And it really allows us to create a funding source that is produced in the region and then benefits people who both live in the region and those who travel from greater Minnesota to be in the region. So here's some background on the fare box recovery ratio, because people ask this often. These are a list of several transit systems around the country. You can see that the Twin Cities system has a fare box recovery of about 28%. We really fall behind only San Diego, Seattle, and Milwaukee, and San Diego is so far out of line with everyone else, we're about even with Seattle and Milwaukee because they have a special transit line that goes to Tijuana, and they get a lot of revenue from that particular transit service. So one of the
I sell souvenirs on the train.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we're not sure that would work here if we had one to Des Moines.
Tequila with the worm in it.
Go so well. A thing that's really important about this quarter cent sales tax, it benefits all transit services and all providers. Bus, local and express, whether operated by Metro Transit or by the suburban transit providers, rail, both light rail and commuter rail, and of course Metro Mobility. So it really provides additional resources for all different modes of transit. And then, going back to the slide that I opened with, this is really the small gray lines that you see here really are regular, you probably can't see them all that well, but those are the regular route bus services on our high-frequency bus service throughout the region, some of our express bus service, and then as I described to you, the light rail line blue for Hiawatha, the green line is that will open next year. Eventually, if we get enough funding for the Southwest LRT, will be extended out to Eden Prairie and Hopkins, and then the BRT line coming up from Apple Valley to Hiawatha. So what's exciting about what will this quarter cent buy? What will it fund? Because I think as policymakers, that's really one of the important questions you have to answer, is that this additional sales tax would, in fact, fund up to 21 transitways over the next 20 years. So this is really an investment for the future of our region and our state. It would allow us to open up three new BRT lines. You can see the brown line out to the east. We're doing an alternatives analysis in the East Metro for the Gateway Corridor, which would go out towards Woodbury and would connect up with the Green Line at the Union Depot. It would allow us to complete the Green Line to the west, which will connect with the current Green Line at the baseball stadium in downtown Minneapolis. That would go all the way out to Eden Prairie, Minnetonka, Hopkins, run through St. Louis Park. We are in an alternatives analysis on the blue line, which heads up from Minneapolis up to the north. And then you can see there are many kind of, I call maroon lines. I'm not sure if that's the right color. But those are examples of the types of investments that would need to be studied and invested in for future development in the region. So we would expect the yellow lines are an exciting investment. Those are our doing our first study and analysis of those lines. We think there's tremendous potential for increased ridership and increased speed for those that operate on major arteries within the metro area. And this new quarter-cent sales tax would really allow us to purchase all of these investments for the region. So, you know, why would you do this? There's been a great study done by the ATASCA project, which is a coalition of CEO business leaders who have been very involved in trying to tackle a lot of issues to improve the economic climate and the success of our region to compete. And they have done a return on investment study that they really took our transportation policy plan and said, gee, if you could, in fact, build it out, what would the return on that investment be? And with that, they have found in this study a $6 to $10 billion return on investment, which includes travel time savings for individuals and businesses, reduced vehicle operating cost, saving to shippers, and improved emissions. And I'm sure you'll be hearing from this group later in your testimony. You know, the transit investments, you know, are so important to the economy of our region and our state. It is how people get to work. People aren't going to stay at a job they can't get to. They're not going to apply for a job they can't get to. So this transit system is really a vital part of providing opportunity throughout our region. Today, there are 94 million transit rides per year provided by the system. That's more than a quarter million rides every day. So it really touches the lives of many, many people. 80% of the people on the transit system are going to work and they're going to school. And in Minneapolis itself, 40% of the people who work in downtown Minneapolis take some mode of transit to get and in fact, our MetroPass program, which is now in its 15th year, which is a partnership that we have with metropolitan businesses and employers. We have about 260 companies that participate in that program and over 33,000 employees who benefit from MetroPasses that are partially subsidized by their businesses and employers. So that's an example of businesses saying, yeah, this is really a good investment for us as we're recruiting and retaining workers.
Chair Hague, if I'm not mistaken, I think I read a newspaper article a few days ago about MAP 21 increasing the level of tax deductibility, or at least the pre-tax dollars that are allowed for that benefit for employers. Is that true, and have you noticed anything different since then?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I did read that article, and I did see that, but I do not know the details, and I'm not sure if Brian knows or you know, Judd.
Mr. Chair and members, Judd Shetland, the Government Affairs Director of the Met Council, I know on Monday we'll be before this committee giving an overview of MAP 21 and the benefits to transit, and we'll go into the detail about it at that.
Great. Thank you.
So as we think about what we hear from the businesses who have helped helped us put together this idea that came forward from the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee to the governor get into the governor's budget is that, you know, they don't want to be in the transportation business. They want to stay in their core business, and they are appreciate having a partner who is really skilled and competent in managing the transit side of this business. So as we think about work and how it connects people to work, it certainly creates construction jobs when we're building these big projects. And I know you've all seen that because you have traversed construction over the last year and a half to 2 years. I can say that we are now 87% complete with construction on the Green Line. But during that period of time, there have been 4,800 jobs created. And those people who work in those jobs have actually come from virtually almost every county in the state, except for maybe six or seven counties. So they're good jobs. People travel a long ways to get these jobs. What's really important about these major transit ways is how they connect people to work in both the Green Line. In a quarter that has about 280,000 jobs. We expect that that will grow to about 374,000. And that is true with the Southwest LRT line. There are about 210,000 jobs in that quarter, a very job-rich quarter. And we expect growth of at least up to 270,000 jobs. So very important investment to help people get to work. And I'm sure you'll hear more about this from the chambers themselves, and they'll probably want to tell this story because they were the ones that sponsored this survey. But they did a survey this month of Minnesota residents, and not just people in the region, and 8 out of 10 agreed that Minnesota would benefit from having an expanded and improved public transit system, including rail and buses. And that there was two-thirds of the residents statewide supported a metro sales tax to increase funding for transit. And here's a couple of quotes from the chambers. The first is from Todd Klingel, president of the Minneapolis Chamber of Commerce. The second from Matt Kramer, who is president of the St. Paul Area Chamber. And then also from the former president of the Twin West Chamber about why they have been partnering with us as we've been trying to find what is the right revenue source to fund the transit system going forward. What they see is this is a good business sense and a good business decision. So why does it make sense for people who don't choose to use transit? And I think this is I don't know if you can see this that well. Those are actually individuals in that photo. The people on the left show the number of people who would be on a bus. If every single one of those people were in a car, the photo on the right shows the number of cars that would be on our highway. And as you know, today, about one-third of our peak hour users of our major freeways during our congested times are on transit. So the more that we can provide choice for people to take transit during peak hours of congestion, it improves congestion for other users. What is exciting to me about this is that this picture really shows that, you know, you either have a choice between 69 people on a bus or 69 cars on the road. And I think this shows why, in fact, this congestion impacts all of the residents of the metro area, whether they are, in fact, transit riders or not. You know, the other important reason that we invest in transit for the future of our economy and the health of our region really has to do with the environmental benefits. Buses are getting greener and better and more fuel efficient. All the time. Right now, we have about 15% of the entire fleet at Metro Transit is a hybrid bus. Our hybrid buses have reduced our emissions by about 85% over the buses they've replaced. So the technology is changing quickly to be more energy efficient and to provide better health and quality for us. And it improves our use of fuel and fuel economy. So ultimately, it's going to save us money and make us less dependent on foreign fuels. So the other key thing about transit is that it really leads to development. You know, when the Hiawatha Light Rail Line was being planned, one of the planning activities that we had to take was to really estimate, well, gee, how many housing units would be built if we created a transit way along the Hiawatha Light Rail Line, and when would they occur? So initially, we estimated that it would take us to be about 7,120 units by 2020. Well, we far exceeded that already in 2009 and 10. There are nearly 10,000 new housing units that have been built along the Hiawatha Light Rail Line because people want to live next to something that's easy and convenient. So the other significant idea behind that is not just for housing units, but for all development. What we've seen so far, this is a photo here of a development that if you drive back and forth on University Avenue, you would have seen this. It's at Dale and University. This is the Frogtown Commons. This is a both a mixed-use development with some affordable rental, some senior rental, and some market-rate stores on the bottom. And it's an example of the type of more dense development we'll see along this corridor. In fact, since we have started the engineering and construction of the Central Corridor Light Rail Line, we have now seen there's been $1.2 billion in development along that corridor. Okay. It's really been quite significant. And that is a year before that line opens. In 2012 alone, there have been 18 new projects there. We expect that these projects will have about 2,300 housing units. So this transitway investment is an attractive place for the market to come to build housing, to create job opportunities for our region.
Chair Hague, did I just hear or read that there's a proposal for the Sears site next door?
And Mr. Chair, there's some interesting discussion going on right now by the City of St. Paul with Sears about a mixed-use, higher-dense development on the Sears site to include housing, commercial development, and retail as well. So very exciting. That's a big piece of property.
Right. Is Sears staying? Are they going? What are they doing?
No. Sears is seeking to act as a developer for that site and would like to stay and kind of reconfigure its retail presence there and invest in other housing and commercial development on that site.
I think most would agree that whole area could use a little, right. A little sprucing up. I don't know. Thanks. Senator Peterson.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Hague, to that point, in regards to the development on the previous slide, the $1.2 billion, does that come from the building permits in those municipalities?
Yes.
Along the corridor? Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator, we have collected data from St. Paul and Minneapolis about the building permits that have been last year along the corridor, and it's really been it was surprising to me how much building construction was going on in the corridor.
But, Chair Hague, City of St. Paul hasn't collected $1.2 billion in building permit fees.
No,
okay.
They've not. No.
Just wanted to make sure people watching are thinking. But St. Paul would be happy. All right, thanks. Oh, Senator Osmick.
Mr. Chair, to that point, how much of that development, $1.2 billion of development, has been publicly subsidized or is somewhere receiving public financing to create this housing?
Chair Hague.
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmick, we can get you that specific information. The vast majority of the amount of that $1.2 billion is private. I would say I don't want to answer without finding, but less than 10% probably public subsidy for that.
Mr. Chair, yes, I definitely want to know the level of public subsidies that are going into these things. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator
Chair Hague, if you could share that with the whole committee. Thank you.
I think one of the things you'll see in it, there's a lot of very high-end luxury rental apartment units built along the corridor that are without any subsidy whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
I think this slide is important to say that, you know, today as we plan for our transit system and our transportation system, we're obviously planning for growth. We've recently done growth projections for the metropolitan region. We expect that the region is going to grow by 900,000 people in the next 30 years. There'll probably be another, you know, 500,000 or more jobs created during that 30-year period. And significantly, growth in the senior population is going to double in the next 30 years. And so, you know, how do you meet the demands for additional transit services as the baby boomers age and live longer? Will probably drive less and have more demand both for regular transit service and for Metro Mobility service. So we know that transit will probably be seeing different types of demand and growth in the future as that demographic population changes.
Chair Hague, who gets to commute in a helicopter?
I don't know. I asked that question when I saw it on the slide. I was like, where is that?
Celine Dion, I know,
I think
goes
it's
back and forth.
Supposed to be the person monitoring traffic.
Okay, very good.
I think it's supposed to be reflecting the congestion on the roadways with the additional population growth. And then finally, I think this is something that's been interesting to me, and this is really something that has come forward in the reports done by the Itasca Project. They did a series of interviews with recruiters at the large Fortune 500 companies here in the metro area to say, you know, why is transit important? What we hear from the HR directors in those companies is that, you know, transit is really important to both attract and retain younger workers. People's attitudes about transit today are changing. People who are fully wired and on their iPads and on their phones and on their laptops like the ability to sit on a train or a bus and continue to do work. It's a new way of living and working, and it's a new aspect of commuting that's changing demand for transit. Some interesting statistics about drops in the number of young people getting driver's license. It's really reflecting this demand nationwide. Choosing to use transit because it fits their lifestyle better. So an important factor is, how do our competitor regions fund transit? And does the sales tax make sense? Why is the governor proposing the sales tax, and how do we stack up with the regions that we compete with around the country? Well, in fact, the sales tax is a source that most of our competitor regions use around the country to fund their transit system. And it can vary from as much as you see here, the big penny with a little bit more on it in San Francisco. And in fact, we learned that King County, which surrounds the Seattle transit system, has actually increased their sales tax, although it's not reflected on here, to 1.8 cents for their region. But you can see that Atlanta, Dallas, Denver, Houston, Seattle, San Jose, St. Louis, Phoenix, Salt Lake City. This is how regions are funding their transit systems. I think because the sales tax is both predictable and it grows with population growth. So as transit demand grows, the sales tax grows with that growing population and the demand needed. When the cities that we compete with pass their sales tax authorization, they then went to expand their transit system in correspondence with the revenue that they secured. So, you know, without this additional revenue, we are going to face significant challenges in the transit and transportation budget for the region. If we do not get additional revenue, we will need to have at least $18 million from the general fund, both for operations for the Blue Line, the Hiawatha Light Rail Line, and the Green Line, the Central Corridor Light Rail Line. So funding both capital and operating is important, and that's the other good advantage of this quarter cent sales tax is it provides for funds for both capital and operating. Secondly, you know, we're going to be faced with the challenge of coming up with $118 million to fulfill the state and local share for the $1.2 billion Southwest LRT project. We're in engineering on that, and we have significant commitments from our federal funding partners and from our local funding partners through Hennepin County and CTIB. But this is a big chunk that needs to be secured. And, of course, that is competing with other many needs around the state. To meet growth in the demand for not just regular route transit service, but for Metro Mobility Service, which is our fastest growing service level of demand, 9% growth in a demand for Metropolitan Mobility Services this past year. We simply will not be able to maintain current service levels, and we will not be able to expand the system to meet growth. So the status quo outcomes are, you know, really, as I showed you, we don't expand this map to serve the entire region. We are not going to be focused on expansion. Our services will fail to keep up with demand. We'll have increased congestion around the region, and we will have to come back to the legislature to ask for additional resources for Southwest LRT. So this is, you know, finally, again, the idea of what it can be. We can make an investment region-wide to serve north and south and east and west. And in my role at the council, and this is true for you, too, as legislators. You know, I am constantly hearing from people who want to make sure that their part of the region is being served adequately, that the resources aren't going to some other part of the region and that their part of the region is losing out. So the idea of creating enough capacity for what is essentially just 1% annual growth in our Metro Transit system, that's what this quarter-cent sales tax would help us to respond to. I don't think that's an extravagant amount of growth that we're projecting. I think it's actually fairly conservative and certainly in line with the population growth for the region. So with that, we'd be happy to answer questions, and thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Chair Hague. I have one quick question that I'd just like to ask. I think I know the answer, but I just want to ask it in a public setting. We know the workhorse, and you might have said it already, so I apologize. The workhorse of the system, of course, is the regular route scheduled bus system. Would the governor's budget proposal really provide for stability and increased demand for that just kind of basic piece of our transit system?
Mr. Chair and Senators, yes, it absolutely would. And if you look at this map with all of the yellow lines on it, you know, that is the investment that we would like to make in those very highly traveled, densely populated corridors to improve travel time, to provide more reliable and faster concept, which is pretty exciting, which significantly reduces travel time and, of course, encourages more people to take transit as that travel time is less and less. So that's the big issue for us as we're trying to invest in the system.
Right.
Is to try to make investments that really decrease travel time and help to relieve congestion.
And the gray lines, the skinny gray lines.
Those are our regular route. The
right.
Skinny gray lines are the regular route bus service.
That's what I'm most interested in.
You know, we do route service planning all the time throughout the region and go out to the community and talk about what types of service levels and frequencies. And mostly we want people to come and say we want more buses more frequently for longer hours. That's generally what we hear when we're out in public hearings.
I'll say I take the bus a lot. I'll add my voice, too. especially in the wintertime when it's chilly. Thank you. I have Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Questions regarding this 25%. Have you done any analysis on a family of four, how much this is going to impact a family of four within the metropolitan area when you impose this additional 0.25% on top of the Twin Stadium tax, on top of the rest of the taxes? How much is this actually going to cost a family of four?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Senator Osmick, a lot of the overarching budget material, this comes in the context, of course, of lowering the overall rate and broadening the base. So some of that analysis is provided by the governor's office as well. But Senator Chair Hague.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Osmick, most of our additional quarter cent is on the lowered sales tax rate. So the rate overall is going down from 6.85 to 5.5. So this is an addition to the 5.5 of 5, so it'd be 5.75. So I don't have specific information about that, and I'm assuming perhaps we can get that from the State Department of Revenue.
Mr. Chair, it wasn't so much the question on the 5 point, what are we going to do with the sales tax? It's more of we're increasing a quarter of a percent across a family of four who already are paying a significant portion of taxes and sales taxes. I'm wondering what the margin on a family that makes $60,000 a year gross income, what is that actually going to hit them in the pocketbook? And that's really the point of that question.
Mr. Chair, Senator,
go ahead.
There'd be many offsetting costs with people's time sitting in cars and congestion. There's a lot of different ways at looking at return on investment. And that return on investment study that the Itasca project did really, I think, addresses a lot of those other economic impact issues, and that would be good to look at as well.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Osmick.
To that return on investment question, I read the study that came out prior to the Hiawatha line opening, and their number had a 40-cent return on investment per dollar. I guess I would find it rather interesting that the Itasca project has now come out with $6 to $10 billion worth of investment, considering the Hiawatha line was a net loss. Can you talk to the Hiawatha? I don't know if you've read the, I think it was from McAllister College. Can you talk to that return on investment number for a Hiawatha corridor?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Senator, I do not know the answer to that question.
Okay. Mr. Chair, question regarding the Fairbox recovery percentage. You've got listed here at 27.9%. Does that include, including amortized costs for the actual build out of the system? Many times I think we look at percentages and we see, geez, it looks pretty normal, but is that inclusive of the $785,000 build out cost, I think it was, on Hiawatha Corridor?
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmond, the Fairbox recovery is based on operations. That's how the metro transit systems around the country measure and benchmark their efficiency.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Osmond.
So it does not include the actual cost of building the particular project. Question on Southwest light rail.
Chair Osmond, or Senator Osmond.
You indicate 3,650 jobs in your presentation. Is it your position that if we didn't spend that on the light rail Southwest corridor, that we couldn't possibly create jobs, building bridges, laying asphalt, eliminating bottlenecks? Is that your position, that we wouldn't be able to spend it there?
Well, Senator Osmick, we know those funds are not fungible. So these are a lot of dollars federally that would simply go to other regions around the country. But Chair Hague?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Osmond, I think you probably are aware of this, but for the capital share of the Transitway investment line, like the Southwest LRT project, 50% of that money comes from our federal partners. That could not go to roadway. That is specifically for New Start Transitway projects. So that would not go to some other place in this region. And because we compete for those project dollars, it's not allocated to us on a population basis or a state basis or regional basis. We compete based on how competitive the project is, how cost-effective it is, and and how many riders uses.
And, Mr. Chair and Senator Osmick, to that point as well, as Chair Haig mentioned, 50% of those funds, the capital funds, come from the feds. Also, 30% come from the CTIB counties, and that money statutorily is dedicated to be used for transitway capital and transitway operations. So that money would be off the table, as well as the 10% that comes from the county regional rail authority, which, again, can be used for, cannot be used for things like you just did.
So, Senator Osmick, the answer is no.
Fair enough, Mr. Chair. Just a couple more questions.
Go ahead.
In Senator Southwest Osmick. Transit, with the implementation of the Southwest Rail Line, is there any impact or perceived or projected impact to the Southwest express bus service that's currently in use? It is certainly a very popular, and it will be significantly faster than light rail getting people between Eden Prairie and points west into Minneapolis. Is there any anticipated reduction of services, or is there any planned reduction in services?
Chair Haig. Senator Osmond, the difference between the service on the express bus service that Southwest Transit Service operates now, of course, it's not station to station all day long. It's just in express. It's just during the peak hours. And the big difference with Southwest LRT in terms of serving the community is that's all day service with, probably 10, I don't know, if the headways are 10 minutes. Yes. 10 minute headways on that line, virtually all day long. So it's a completely different type of service.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Osmick, I can respond as well. I take the bus from Minneapolis to the Capitol, and people often say, oh, I bet you can't wait till Central Corridor. I say, well, that'll be nice, but I'll probably still take the 94 across because it's an express bus, and really the point of LRT is the service in between and all the points in between. So it's not necessarily about point-to-point service. So I anticipate that Southwest Transitway, Southwest Transit Service Express from that quadrant of the metro to downtown will still serve an important function.
Fair enough, Mr. Chair. And that was the concern that I have, is that the Southwest Transit people are saying, how can you possibly believe that you're going to run an express bus directly in parallel with the Southwest Corridor light rail, that they believe that they would be impacted in some way. But what I'm hearing here is that there is no anticipated, at least at this time, any impact to them.
So, Senator Osmick, I'm a little above my pay grade. I don't know if there's going to be no impact, but there will certainly be a purpose for express service from point to point.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmick, this, of course, is a proposal to grow the entire transit system. So this additional revenue would help to allow additional revenue for other transit providers, Southwest Transit. And in addition, as we get 900,000 more people living in this metropolitan area, those highways are going to get more congested, even if we build out as much of this transit system as we would like to. So population growth is going to continue to, challenge us. And what's great about our fixed route service is that they don't compete with cars for roadway.
Fair enough. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. I have... Here's my speaker's order. Senator Reinert, Franz, and Westrum, then Kiffmeyer. Senator Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair and Judd, as I'm looking at the transit network map, I'm curious, of course, about the southern portion of the NLX line, which will be commuter rail from Minneapolis to Forest Lake. And I don't see it on the map, and I'm just wondering at what point I could expect to see it on the map as part of this initiative.
Sure, hey.
Mr. Chair, and perhaps I'd ask you to address your question to MnDOT too, since they're doing the planning for the statewide service there, and perhaps they could answer that question better than I could.
So, Mr. Chair, follow up.
Senator Reinert.
So you're waiting on MnDOT to, I think we've defined the rail corridor because we're in the EIS process.
Mr. Chair, our map really shows mobility and transit investment within the 7 metro county region and does not show the statewide investment in additional rail. So that is something that MnDOT would be leading today, and I'm sure we would be working with them on that investment as they do that. planning going forward.
And Mr. Chair, just one more follow-up.
Senator Reiner.
You know, I asked the question because the North Star, I get, ends at Big Lake, but, you know, it has an important connection as well to a regional center in St. Cloud. NLX is going to be exactly the same. It's going to, on the southern end, be more frequent transit to serve a commuter function between Minneapolis and Forest Lake, with Forest Lake being in the seven-county metro area. You know, it then will extend on up to Hinckley and eventually Duluth, but that's passenger component. So I just think as we look at these things and potentially envision this function, we have to be mobile and nimble enough to consider a line that will serve more than one purpose, on one end commuter and on the other end passenger.
It's good. It's an excellent point, Senator Reiner. Yeah, the NLX is kind of a different breed of cat, as you pointed out, commuter and intercity components. I do anticipate that Met Council with the new commissioner, Charlie Zelli, MnDOT, will kind of figure out how to do this joint planning, make sure it fits in with this map so that the corresponding planning is taken into account, and you know, coordinating who goes first, what's on second, whose money is in, and who's going to own and operate these sorts of things. So it's an excellent point. We need to need to have these conversations sometimes. Overlap. So MnDOT, you heard that. NLX, we want to hear about it when, in your presentation. Thanks. Let's see. We have Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hague, my question is regarding the Southwest Light Rail as well. And you said that without new revenue, we wouldn't be able to fund the additional investment that's required to continue with the project. Looking at the quarter-cent sales tax and the different impact fiscal year 14 and 15, we wouldn't be able to fund it completely in 14, and we could fund it by 2015, but what impact would that have in your overall planning if we're taking a significant amount of those funds to pay for this with these funds?
Chair Hague.
Mr. Chair, Senator Franzen, the additional quarter-cent sales tax would allow us to generate enough revenue to cover the entire state share for Southwest LRT, because based on the predictability and the certainty of that sales tax revenue, then the Metropolitan Council would bond for that instead of asking the state of Minnesota to have to bond for that based on that revenue stream. So there would be enough revenue there to be able to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great question. Senator Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hague, you mentioned something about Metro Mobility and the growth there. Can you just talk a little bit more about that in a second part to the question? A few years ago, several years ago, actually, we worked with the Metro Transit folks and Metro Mobility specifically on implementing what they call a taxi ticket, where riders would have a same-day option, a more last-minute or quicker ride potentially. They'd have to contribute a little bit more to the fare. How is that going? And is with the growth that you say is there a way to expand that program to offer better or more services, but riders would pick up some more of the share and deal with that growth?
Well, yep, I think we're going to hear a little bit about, I'll say it, the solar tsunami and and Metro Transit expected growth, and then some of the dial ride and other kinds of service. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom. So the Metro Mobility demand for service is probably one of our fastest growing demand for service. I said it was about 9% last year. That's very significant increase. We're projecting a continued significant increase in demand. I am not an expert on the actual service delivery mechanism, but I do have a Metro Council staff person here, Amy Venowitz, who could probably better answer your question if I could call her up.
Ms. Venowitz.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm not sure I caught all the details of the question, but what I can tell you is we do have a same-day taxi service, and you can call and order your ride on the same day. It, depending on your disability, you might get a bus. You might lower-level disabilities can use a taxi service. And I do not believe the fare is higher on the taxi. I think they pay the standard Metro Mobility fare.
And I think the question was, how's it going?
Mr. Chair, how's it going, and is that a aspect we could look at to deal with some of that growth? And last weekend I spoke at one of the statewide councils for the Blind Association, discussed it with them, and in that group it was a very popular option, and I hear you talking about the growth, and I thought, you know, it hasn't been revisited for several years, maybe we should. And I thought they told me they could pay up to $7 towards the fare, and then after they pay the first $7, and then the taxi ticket pays for the next portion, and if it gets to be too long of a ride, then they have to pay the last part of it as well. But we could talk about that offline, but I'm just suggestion, but also interested in your feedback of how that's working.
Ms. Benowitz.
Mr. Chair and Senator, we'll get back to you with the details, but the Metro Mobility Service is all a contracted service. So we have providers who are both taxi cab services and then providers where we provide the bus and then they run the actual service. One thing I want to clarify about Metro Mobility is we have a zero denial on Metro Mobility. So in other words, we are required to provide the service in areas within three quarters of a regular route. And so we meet the demand that is out there. And a denial is not just saying no, but it's if you're not within the customer's time frame, that is also considered a denial. So Metro Mobility, we put the level of service out there that is required based on our customers' demand. And to the degree that we can use taxi cab service, we do, and we do have them under contract. So whether it needs to grow relative to the bus service we provide, I would have to get back to you on whether that's a possibility.
Thank you. All right. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And good to see you, and good information. I appreciate it very much. But on this information, I have a slide here that talks about the metro area growing and changing. And it takes some assumptions here, such as by 2030, the metro area will add 900,000 people and so on. There must be a study or some assumptions or information that this is from. Is that noted anywhere here on this slide that I can go to or could have sent to me?
Mr. Chair, that doesn't say on this slide, but it undoubtedly comes from the forecast that the Metropolitan Council is required by state law to do on population growth. That's kind of the underpinnings of our one of our responsibilities. So we do that forecasting ourselves, and I'd be happy to send that information to you.
And Chair Hague, is it true this is about 100,000 or more less than was anticipated even a few years ago, so this is about a little bit of a dialing back of some assumptions.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the projection, now this is, we do a 30-year projection, so this would be the projection going to, which seems like a long time from now, but it is just around 900,000, and it is slightly, it is a slower rate of growth than the previous projection from the previous decade. It's still a significant level of growth. There are a couple of significant issues that we've seen as we've done these projections, and of course the most significant really is the doubling of the aging population, the senior population. We all grew up, or most of us, or at least I'm a baby boomer, grew up where we always didn't have that many people at the top, a lot of people in the middle, and then a lot of kids at the bottom, that kind of pyramid. These new projections are going to look like this, a lot more people at the top, a lot more people at the bottom, and not so many people in the center. And that's a significant issue for us on a variety of policy and infrastructure investment issues, but certainly it is for transit and transit demand and the type of services that people want.
And Chair, just a quick question, and I'll get back to you. Thanks. Does the Metropolitan Council make use of the state demographer? Is that the core resource?
We use a lot of the same resources that they do, the same economic tools that they do, and we do our separate forecasting based on some more detailed data for the region.
Thank you.
Because it is that then that local communities use as they create their local comprehensive plans and plan for their own growth.
Thank you. Senator Kipmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think my main point is, especially when you are forecasting out a very slight change because of that time issue, can have a huge impact, and these are significant because you're making decisions based upon that. So I just wanted to know the underlying assumptions. The other thing is that having served on Health and Human Services the last 4 years and lots of demographic changes, quite familiar with that, but assuming that the behavior of the previous 30 years of retirees is the same as the future 30 years of retirees is a very a difficult thing to do. Our retirees now are not taking some of the same approaches that was in the past.
60s,
and you have
to
be really
40.
Careful,
yes,
about those assumptions and what they all do and what they all mean, and especially since I come from, I find anyway, we come here and we spend a lot of time in Minneapolis, St. Paul, mm-hmm. but I assure you when I drive home at night, it's a different atmosphere. And so I know we're hearing about the Metropolitan. We certainly care about our inner city folks and what they're all doing. I there's a lot of good things, your theaters, there's a lot of good things and folks that I know. But just want to be sure. I think that Senator Reinert, Greater Minnesota, Senator and some of that. But the biggest thing is that the underlying assumptions, and I wanted to read those for myself to kind of get a feel for that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. I think we'd all be interested. Chair Haig?
Mr. Chair, we can certainly provide that to the committee members, the growth projections and the assumptions that they're based on.
Thank you. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, I asked this of Commissioner McLaughlin also. On a couple of slides here, you have leading to development, housing, as well as the looking like it's commercial industrial too. Have you, can you, will you put together something that shows us what the tax increment is, the growth of the tax base along these corridors? We've talked about methods to capture the increment in value at sometimes, but I know that there's an increment in value, and I'd like to see what that looks like. We know that there's a lot of new development along the Hiawatha Corridor that wouldn't have happened had Hiawatha Corridor not been put there. So I'd like to know what the dimensions of that are.
Mr. Chair, I certainly don't have that off the top of my head, and I know we've done some studies looking at, I know along the Central Corridor we have an investment framework study looking at, you know, what the value increase will be along that line. I'm not sure if what method we would have or collect it. We'd probably rely on the cities and the counties to gather that information.
Thank you. All right, members, if there's nothing further, we have another agency to hear from before we wrap up for the day. So anything further, members? Nope. Thank you very much, and you're not going to be too late to your council meeting. So
thank you very much.
Race down the hill. Appreciate your time. So we have the Department of Transportation, and we're going to hear from the Chief Financial Officer, Tracy Hatch. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. One second while we work the technology.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for having us here. We are here to present to you a kind of a hybrid overview. I believe last week you heard from Commissioner Zelli, and you got a high-level overview on a few slides regarding our funding. And so today we wanted to give you a little bit more of a flavor for that and also go into the governor's recommended change items for 14 and 15.
Thank you.
So I will try not to be redundant and try not to spend time on stuff you've already seen, and we'll just kind of breeze past that. Again, as a reminder, last week when you heard from Commissioner Zelli presented on our base, our 14 and 15 fiscal base. And so today I'm here to present to you on our fiscal base plus the governor's recommended change items since the governor's budget has been released. We'll start real high level here. First, I want to just give you a little flavor. I know you saw this also last week, but again, I always like to start with a sense of what it is that we are responsible for in the transportation sector. You'll see here for state highways, there is 137,800 miles of state, county, city, and township roadways. And of that, MnDOT is directly responsible for 11,900 miles. You'll also see, I won't read all of these to you, but you'll also see that we are at MnDOT also responsible for 3,267 bridges. A few more statistics, certainly about our modal investments, water freight, rail freight, transit, and bike and pedestrian facilities. So I wanted to give you a little bit of a flavor. I think maybe you've seen this before as well, but a little flavor regarding the workforce at MnDOT. This shows actuals for 2011 and 2012 and our forecast for 2013. So in 2011, we had 4,964 employees. As you're all, I'm sure, aware, we had the early retirement incentive, which was a great tool that MnDOT used to do some redeployment and adjustment of our workforce. We brought our workforce down by 450 staff, and we held those vacancies as long as we could, did some kind of redesign of some areas and looked to see what positions we could not fill and what positions we needed to fill, and then what levels those positions were at. And so, as you can see, we're expecting to be at 4,882 employees for fiscal 13. I will also give you a little heads up that you've probably seen this before. You'll see this in other presentations, but in fiscal 14, the employees that are IT-related will be pulled out of all of the agency's compensation and FTE numbers and will be moved over to MnDOT, so you'll see that as well.
Ms. Hatch, last year an issue came up around that subject of the operation, the, you know, the state roadway management center. You know, is run by computers. It's not an IT function per se. It's a traffic management operation, and there was some discussion about that finer point. Both the who should own that technology and to whom those employees should report. Has that been settled?
Mr. Chair, members, I do believe that that has been settled, and I couldn't give you specifics today, but I do believe that the bulk of that was deemed to be transportation-related is still maintained at MnDOT, and the components that were related to things like servers and direct IT investments are moving to MnDOT and are in the IT budget. But we'd be happy to get you a more detailed breakdown on that and exactly how that was resolved.
That would be interesting. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, members, continuing on, you'll see here expenditures by fund. I'm now on slide 5 in your packets. This is, again, real high level, but just wanted to give you a flavor of what transportation funds we have spending that comes out of. And when we say expenditures by fund, and you'll hear me say the word expenditures throughout the day, throughout the presentation, and when I say expenditures, I actually mean our planned spending, forecast-based plus governor's recommendation. 54%.
Oh, excuse me. Members, I just want you to know that there's not a lack of interest in this subject, but a couple of other committees are overlapping with some hot debates going on, and they have to be there. So there's not a lack of interest in this particular subject area, just demanding times right now. So thank you. Please continue.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So again, this is planned. Anytime you see expenditures in my presentation, it's planned spending, forecast base, plus governor's change items. You'll see 79% is for highways. That's including the trunk highway and the county state aid highways, as well as municipal state aid highways, and 21% for our modal investment areas. This is a little bit more detail on those investments broken down. You'll see the first two numbered columns are fiscal year 12 and 13. Fiscal year 12 is not completely closed yet. It's considered preliminary close. Fiscal 13 is our current projection for 13, and then you'll see our biennial total there. And then moving over the last three columns represent our fiscal 14 and 15 planned spending as well as our biennial total. I expected that you may have some questions a little bit about what the changes were, so I thought we'd provide you a little bit more detail here, and there's a lot more detail we can provide you. So any question that any of you may have, we'd be happy to either meet with you individually, come back another day, or provide information via email follow-up. But here you'll see we have our biennial total in 12 and 13 was $5.2 billion. For all modes. And again, this is our forecast spending. I keep saying forecast spending because there's a big component of that that's built into our budget, and much of that is based on statutory appropriations, which we'll talk about here in another minute. You'll see we're asking for spending up to $6 million, just over $6 million. And then some of the key changes, why we're asking for that. I know it appears like a significant jump there, and we wanted to provide you a little context there in the far right margin where it says key changes. I will get into the general fund change. You'll see $20 million there requested for the Transportation Economic Development Program. And I'll talk about that when I get to talking a little bit more about the governor's change items. We have some special revenue funds that we're, again, forecasting additional spending and due to additional projects and partnerships, things of that nature. Most of the increase you'll see there is also offset by additional expenditure and revenue. So there isn't actually a kind of a windfall to the department, if you will. We also wanted to point out that of the $784 million you'll see where it says in the dollar change column, that third column from the right, $412 million of that is part of the forecasted base, and $372,600,000 is part of the governor's recommended budget. And we'll get to that on slide 24 in just a moment. So this is the breakdown by appropriation type. You'll see direct statutory and open appropriations. As you know, direct appropriations are those set by law. You'll be passing, hopefully, an appropriations bill later this session, and that's where we'll get those direct appropriations. 21% of our current budget is based on statutory appropriations, so those appropriations that are made to the department that are set in other legislative action. Kind of a prime example of that is our collection of fees for overweight and oversized vehicles, for example. And then some open appropriations. We have just a very small amount of open appropriations in the department, and those are primarily indirect for central services that are provided by MMB. This, again, is a numbers breakdown of the appropriation type. I'm not sure what level of detail you want to go into here specifically, but I certainly provided it there for you and would be happy at any time to give you more as well. So kind of moving in now to sort of how the department is structured and where expenditures go correspondingly. This is our program and budget structure, and as you know, this is the way that the appropriations will be appropriated to the department in an appropriations bill. And so I just wanted to hit this at a high level, touch a little bit more on the state roads program, and then move into change items. So we have four main program areas at MnDOT, the multimodal systems, the local roads, state roads, and the agency management program. Within multimodal systems, again, it's like it sounds, all the modes. So aeronautics, transit, freight, and passenger rail currently are the modal systems. And then we have local roads. So that's where our state and county, our county and municipal funding is provided through the County State Aid Highway Fund and the Municipal State Aid Streets Fund. And then we have our largest program area, which is the state roads program, and I'm going to just go into that in a little bit more detail to make sure that we're all kind of starting at the same place. But this is our program planning and delivery, budget activity, operations and maintenance, electronic communications, debt service, and state road construction. And whenever we say state road construction, we mean the hard construction, the actual hard construction projects. And then, of course, agency management, which provides some central services as well as all of the buildings support that we need in the department. So this is our expenditures by program type. So multimodal systems, state aid, local roads, and agency management. And the following slide provides a little bit more of a breakdown, annual breakdown. Then when we look specifically at the state roads program, you'll see we have 53% of our total state roads budget is in the state road construction, the hard construction budget. We also have 16% in program planning and delivery, 1% in electronic communications. And I will touch on a change item related to electronic communications a little bit later as well. We also have 18% goes to operations and maintenance, and 12% goes to debt service. I'm going to also touch on debt service here in a minute to give you a little better sense of what that 12% means in context with some other percentages you may hear about related to our debt service. In terms of program planning and delivery, this is often the area of the budget that's the most confusing, hard to understand what's included in that, so I wanted to give you a quick little snapshot. That is all of the system planning and integration work, all of the pre-design, design, all of the pre-engineering or engineering work that takes place up to contract award, all of the contract administration for contracts that are put out to contractors, and it also includes right-of-way purchases, for example. This is, again, if you're into the numbers, this is a little bit more of a breakdown on the numbers by each of those program activities, those budget activities. Program planning and delivery, obviously, is a significant part of getting contracts out the door and getting hard construction projects completed. And you'll see our debt service number there has gone from the 2012-13 biennium of $210 million in a debt service payment to $406 million in the coming biennium. So we also often get questions about categories, types of expenditures. So we wanted to give you a snapshot of that. And again, this slide is, again, all funds, the whole agency. It's not just the State Roads Program. We have about 6% of our total budget going to debt service. 12% goes to payroll, 11% to operating. And when we say operating, we are primarily talking about, it's non-payroll type operating. It's some of that is commodity purchases. Some of that is all of the transportation system operations as well. We have capital outlay and we have grants. The grants number looks like a big number there, so I wanted to give you a little bit of a breakdown of what's included in the grants. That is, it certainly includes grants like we do transit grants, aeronautics grants to local airports, and any freight grants we do. But it also, the biggest chunk of that is the aid and subsidies and grants to local units of government. So the County State Aid Highway Fund and Municipal State Aid Streets funding is there, as well as our Federal County Road and Bridge funding. And again, the corresponding dollars. This is a slide I'm pretty sure you've probably seen before. It's one of my favorite slides. I like to at least throw it in there because we often get questions about what are the revenue sources, how do they come in, and where do they go. These are the three main revenue sources to fund highway transportation, and that is the gas tax, the tab fees, and the motor vehicle sales tax. The other there is primarily represented represents interest income. Those go into the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. We have some, we kind of call it affectionately the leakages, that go out to, for example, DNR. And then we have the remaining funds.
Ms. Hatch, just to be clear, the DNR transfer, that's some money that's scooped off the top for snowmobile trails, ATV trails, that sort of thing.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Right. Essentially, folks that put gas in their lawnmowers and their ATVs and their snowmobiles want to recoup a little bit of that back to be able to fund the transportation functions that they use it for. So part of that gas tax is provided to DNR to take care of trails and that kind of thing.
We have lawnmower trails?
I don't think we have lawnmower trails. Maybe in my yard we do.
Okay. Oh, maybe that's for golf courses.
Golf courses.
How much is that? Is that 1% of all gas tax collected?
It is a very small portion, and I don't have that number on me, but it is a very small. Oh, DNR, about 3%.
3%. Thank you. All right.
So then again, we have the 95% distribution, which funds the three major highway areas, the Trunk Highway Fund, the County State Aid Highway Fund, and the Municipal State Aid Streets Fund, and those, as you know, are spelled out in the Constitution. The remaining 5% is what we call the 5% set-aside. That is identified in the Constitution, and then the flexible highway account, the town roads and town bridges receive the funding from that 5%. Since we're talking about the gas tax, we also often get asked about our gas tax and the current rate and how we compare, so we thought we'd put this bit of information in there. We technically have a 25-cent gas tax with a 3.5-cent debt service surcharge, making up the total of 28.5 cents. Bonding also is a pretty popular topic for us, and we do have some general obligation bonds, and I wanted to make sure we had an understanding of the distinction. General obligation bonds cannot be used on the trunk highway system, and conversely, trunk highway bonds cannot be used on the local system, and we also cannot use the trunk highway bonds on modal investments. Debt service for the GO bonds are paid by the general fund. Trunk highway bonds can only be used for trunk highway purposes. We pay a debt service transfer once a year, and often this is kind of confusing for folks. It's technically a transfer. We have included it in all of our documents here for you today in the expenditure area because that's how most folks think of it, but it technically is a transfer that we make to MMB into the debt service fund. We've had authorized about $2 billion since 2008, and we have all of that programmed. And when we say committed, we mean it is either under encumbrance or already spent. So we have right now about just over $1 billion worth of bonds left to sell. And so this is the reason I prefaced the bond conversation was to show you this slide. This is a slide that we often get asked for. So, again, I thought I'd put this in. The red line shows the February forecast last year. So that's the red line. And the blue line shows the November 12 forecast, so the forecast we just put out this past November. As you know, we'll have a new forecast coming out here at the end of February as well. You'll see the blue line is much higher, slightly higher, and then pulled a little bit to the left compared to the red line. And I wanted to make sure you understood that that was because of a couple of things, mostly two bridges, two very large bridge projects that we advanced. They were in the program. We were able to just get them done earlier, needed the cash, so we sold the bonds a little bit earlier. We sold some of those bonds starting this past fall. And then we also had a little bit
attach,
of...
Which two bridges?
I believe it was Dresbach and Winona, I believe.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we also had a little bit of a premium savings from our bonds this last time, not as significant as we've had in the past, but that's the $6 million difference you see there in the 2013 actuals. We have a policy on our debt that says that MnDOT cannot exceed 20% of the state revenues to the Trunk Highway Fund in debt service. And so I wanted to give you a slide here that showed where we are currently sitting. All of this information, by the way, and even more information about the flow of funds and how we calculate things and where things come from are located in our forecast document, which can be found on our website. If you have an interest, we'd be happy to forward you either hard copies or electronic copies as well. As you can see, we reach in 2016, we reach up to 18% as a high point for our current debt policy. And the column to the far right there where it says variance from 20% policy limit, that is the amount of debt service that we could take on technically between the 18% and the 20%. My caveat always on this slide, however, is keep in mind that it is 18% of revenues to the state revenues to the Trunk Highway Fund. And if there was an impact to our gas tax, for example, that would decrease our revenue, 18% could quickly become 20%. And then moving on into the change items, these are the change items all are on the screen there that have a fiscal impact, obviously. The first is the Transportation Economic Development Program. But first, I wanted to give you a little picture of the summary of the expenditure impact from the change items. You'll see that the largest piece there is the state road construction federal funds amount, and that is $125.4 million in fiscal 14 and $137.6 in fiscal 15 for a total of $263 million. And I'm going to get into just a touch more detail on each of these here as we go forward. So again, the Transportation Economic Development, this is a great program. It's a collaboration between MnDOT and DEED. It's been in place for a few years now where we go through a competitive selection process to identify and support projects that assist development of new or expanding businesses, and these we like these to be real jobs, permanent jobs. They also must support the statewide transportation network to be eligible for the Transportation Economic Development Funds. Some of the goals of the program is to address both the economic and the transportation system objectives of the state, again, to create and preserve sort of head-of-household jobs, real-paying jobs, permanent jobs, and then to leverage private and local investments in the public infrastructure improvements. We have a number of collaborations and a number of partnerships among both the public and private sector to support this effort. We've done two solicitations so far. Just by way of background, we received $30 million two biennia ago, and then we received $20 million in an appropriation 2 years ago to support in 2011 to support the program on the Trunk Highway side. And in both of those years, DEED through the PFA also received $3 million of GEO bonds in both of those years. And that's what makes up that $59 million in TED grants that have been provided so far. That $59 million has leveraged over $100 million in other public and private financing. And the estimate is that it will go to support about 10,000 permanent well-paying jobs across the state. It's been a very successful program.
So, Ms. Hatch, So help me understand, what have the appropriations to the TED program been previously?
Mr. Chair, we received, I don't have the bills in front of me, so I can't give you the exact year, but in 2011, for the 12-13 biennial, we received $20 million in trunk highway funds to support that. And we also received the previous biennial, we received $30 million from the trunk highway fund to support to support the effort. And then we also received $3 million in both of those same appropriation years.
In general fund?
In general fund. And excuse me, I believe those were GO bonds.
GO bonds, okay, great. And this proposal in front of us is general fund dollars of $20 million.
Mr. Chair, that's correct, $10 million each year.
And these dollars can be spent on trunk highway purposes? That's
Mr. Chair, unfortunately, they cannot. They would need to be spent only on either the local system. Or to leverage private investment. We would need to preserve, obviously, the trunk highway dollars for the trunk highway system, and constitutionally we're not able to
mix. That's where I was getting confused. Okay, I've been confused about this proposal ever since I've seen it. And I think we would be interested in just knowing a little bit more. I'm sure we got a report, but, you know, maybe in glowing, you know, if there's beautiful pictures for us to see and why this is all wonderful. I think people are pretty excited about it. It'd be interesting to know, maybe you have it here, what the demand was. Oh, yes, 70 applications. You know, so if we had all the money in the world, how much we might be able to spend on this sort of thing. And I had one more question that I can't remember, but please.
Mr. Chair, this is Matt Chans. Matt Chans is our program director for the TED program, and he's here conveniently to be able to answer questions.
I just want to, it's Matt Chans, and I just want to clarify one thing. Mr. Chairman, you asked about whether or not general fund money can be used on the trunk highway system or on the look road system. And one of the nice things about general fund money is there's no limitations in terms of what we can use it on, which will help in terms of giving us greater flexibility in terms of project selection. We'll be able to do more on the local road system, the trunk highway system, but also any of the modal systems as well with general fund.
So it's just we're limited by we cannot use general, we can't use financing, general obligation financing on the trunk highway system.
Right. The bonds. The bonds is where you run into the limitations.
Okay. But cash we can use however we want. Is that correct?
Yes. With general fund money,
there's
no limitation.
Very good. All right. And then there seems to be this, is it going to be in the Tomasoni deed budget or this committee's budget?
Mr. Chair, we're still waiting to hear more detail about that. We knew you'd be interested in it, and it was originally as a change request that we presented, so we included it here for you. It could end up in the economic development bill.
And how, just in practical terms, who runs the show? Senator Senjum's, where does it happen? Who receives the solicitation, who staffs and who makes the decision? How does that happen?
Mr. Chair, Matt Chan.
It's primarily myself at MnDOT, my partner in crime at the Department of Employment and Economic Development is a fellow by the name of Jeremy LaCroix. We're the ones that kind of manage the solicitation process. Then there's a larger committee that gets together to review applications, score the applications. It's folks from DEED, folks from MnDOT, and we call in folks from some economic development authorities around the state to kind of get a better geographic balance. And there's about 10 of us that then score the projects.
Okay. And whose office do you sit in, MnDOT's or DEED's?
DEED's.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. All right. We'll explore the subject a little bit more. It's a very interesting initiative that I think people are excited about. But, you know, we just want to understand it a little bit better. It kind of came up as a MnDOT DEED initiative, and we thought it was a good thing. But now it seems to be catching on. So we'll know more about it. Help you. All right. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, moving on then, the state road construction change item. You'll see in the governor's budget, he noted $338 million. I wanted to make sure you had the breakdown of that. $263 million of that is federal funds from the new authorization, MAP 21, and I believe next Monday you will have Mark Yuski here to speak to you a little bit more in depth about the MAP 21 new authorization legislation and what that means and the dollars associated with it. Essentially, this $263 million is not new money. It's actually already programmed in projects that are included in the STIP, and there will be offsetting expenditures correspondingly. So there's actually no net fiscal impact, and this is essentially us asking for authority to receive the dollars from the feds and to continue to spend them on currently programmed projects. One of the new asks is $75 million of additional state funds from the Trunk Highway Fund balance as a one-time appropriation in fiscal 14. So again, this is a little bit more detail, exactly basically what I just told you about the state road construction appropriation, but it splits out the $263 million by fiscal year. So $125.4 million in fiscal 14 and $137.6 million in fiscal 15. Again, this
is... Ms. Hatch, I'm sorry. Can you back up a step? What is the $75 million in additional from the Trunk Highway? What is that for?
Mr. Chair, the $75 million is one-time funds for additional investments.
Right, okay, yep. Thank you.
It is, again, we're asking for it in fiscal 14, and we have four program areas that we're looking to support with it. The Better Roads Program, other infrastructure needs, primarily drainage. We have a pretty significant drainage concern. We also have some investments that we need to do along the lines of the Americans with Disabilities Act and our corridor investment management strategy. And again, this is funds that are available off the existing fund balance.
Thank you. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question I have, could you give me a little more information about the corridor investment management strategy?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, yes, I can give you a little snapshot myself, and if you'd like more today, I'd be happy to bring someone up to give you a little more detail on that program. Otherwise, I do think that they'll probably cover that in more detail on Monday as well as part of the MAP 21 discussion. Corridor investment management strategy is essentially a way that we are working with and reaching out to regions across the state to work with them to figure out what their transportation needs are in their local communities and how we can work with them and align with them on their investment needs. And I believe that it's sort of an umbrella program by which, for example, TED would sort of fall underneath as well. If you'd like more information, though, we have folks here in the audience that are experts in that area.
Mr. Chairman, if we're going to hear more on Monday, I'll just wait for them.
Okay, very good. Thanks. Continue.
So moving on, we're also asking for a $5 million annual increase in operations and maintenance. And this is essentially to offset commodity inflation that we've experienced over many years. We are expecting to have about $10 million in inflationary effects on our commodities. This does not include any, salary adjustments or inflation on salaries or anything like that. This is purely some of our main commodities like fuel, salt, bituminous, and sand. And at this point, it's just eating up such a big portion of the operating budget cumulatively year after year that we really do need a little bit of assistance. And this is, again, coming straight off the fund balance available in the Trunk Highway Fund.
So should we do any long-term contracts for any of these things?
Mr. Chair, we do. We do. I don't know that I would call them long-term contracts. I believe we can only contract for 2 years at a time. But we do, for example, I know on salt and sand, we buy at the end of the fiscal year before the next fiscal year starts because the contract prices go up with the next each subsequent year. So we try to front load it and buy as much the year or two before as we can to sort of save in the short term.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, then moving on to the Economic Recovery Funds. This is essentially ARRA funds that we received from the federal government back in 2009. MnDOT actually received about $550 million in economic recovery funds, and some of those funds are expected to be spent out even into towards a state fiscal year 16, the end of fiscal year 15. And so we are needing some additional authority from you to continue to spend those funds. The other piece about this that's important is we want to be able to receive funds if additional funds become available. And that did already happen in our passenger rail program. I believe it was the state of Florida wasn't able to use all of their ARRA funds, and so we were able to get them via redistribution. And so we'd like authority to be able to accept those and to continue spending the existing funds that we have. The next change item is the decrease to the State Airports Fund for both fiscal years 14 and 15, $500,000. We have a little bit of an imbalance in the State Airports Fund, and we also have received less in terms of the revenue this past year and what we expect in 14 and 15 as well, primarily as a result of two airlines that are currently in bankruptcy. So we're hoping that at some point we receive those revenues, but in 14 and 15 we felt it necessary to decrease our expenditures to correspond with what we anticipate as a decrease in revenue. We may have to pass these on to grants to local airports. We believe that there's the ability to schedule things and move things to provide a little bit more of a limited impact on them. We are in both fiscal year 13 as well as in 14 and 15 looking at every possible way we can create some internal operational efficiencies to minimize, again, the impacts to the local airports.
Tatch, maybe Senator Rest can help us with this. We don't have to answer this question today, but this bankruptcy situation, what are those airlines' legal obligation? What is our authority to collect on those obligations? Kind of where do we fit in the queue? If the court is helping sort that out, that sort of thing.
Mr. Chair, members, actually, they are is Pinnacle and Mesaba. And you may have seen them actually in the news, and we are watching them very closely and watching the bankruptcy proceedings. Currently, we have been told by the Department of Revenue that they will still be pursuing collection on those revenues that we've missed. You might recall, couldn't even come up with the year, probably maybe 2008, maybe earlier, with Delta, then Northwest. They had about a $4.2 million payment that was due that they weren't able to do because they were in bankruptcy, and that was continued to collect on, and we're expecting actually that to be received this year. But again, that's several years past when we expected to receive the revenue. So we have every expectation we'll get the Delta payment this year, the $4.2 million, and we hope that at some point in the future we will recover the Pinnacle and Mesaba.
Okay. Thank you.
Decreased revenue as well. So the next request we have is for the Regional Development Commission, what we call the RDC State Planning Grants. We have 12 Regional Development Commissions throughout the state. They are partners, very important partners, in the area transportation partnership process. You may have heard of that. It's called the ATP process. These RDCs are involved in solicitating and evaluating projects, in integrating regional priorities and planning with MnDOT planning, and in public involvement activities. They have received $50,000 annually since 1997, and we currently have $600,000 that is set aside in the program planning and delivery account for RDCs. This change would essentially increase the request from $600,000 up to $900,000. It would be able to provide us with an increase to the RDCs of $25,000 each for a total of $75,000 per year. The little note on the bottom there says that $50,000 in 1997 would be about $72,000 today. So we feel like we're right in the ballpark in terms of the inflationary effect, but also, and probably even more importantly, the additional work and requests that we've had of them. They have played an increasingly important role in transportation planning, and we'd like to see us at least try to be able to support them a little bit more in that effort.
So, Ms. Hatch, this would be ongoing, not just a one-time.
Mr. Chair, this would be a base increase.
Base increase,
correct.
Right.
So an additional $300,000 up to $900,000, and then every year after.
Does this relate back to the corridor investment management strategy that Senator Kiffmeyer was asking about? And does this start to get at that question that Senator Senjum is interested in? Where does it happen? How do we establish our list?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm sure it has some kind of an impact. I'm a little bit more on the number side of the game than the policy planning, but we do have someone here that would be happy to come up and answer that question if you'd like it answered today.
I don't know. No, but we do want to explore this. What they do, unless Senator Kiffmeyer wants to hear more today, we do want to understand what exactly do the RDCs do, and what will be our measures, our outcomes, our measures of success. What are the new things? I don't know if I'm going to get into too much detail today, but we're interested.
We will make a note of that, Mr. Chair, and be
all
happy
right.
to get back to you with that either at another hearing or with more detail via email.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, my final slide is two kind of smaller requests that we have. One is actually no fiscal impact, and that is our grade crossing safety account. A couple of years ago, we received an increased appropriation from $600,000 up to $1 million to support the grade crossing safety account from the Trunk Highway Fund. And the language also says that each year the any unspent funds have to be canceled to the Trunk Highway Fund, and it is quite frankly really an operational burden. It is really a laborious process, and every time a PO is closed or canceled and there's a nickel on the table, we have to go in and make adjustments. So and the amount that's left at the end of the year is usually a result not because there isn't a need for the program, not because they haven't committed the funds, but it's actually because of POs that have been closed and we achieved a little bit of savings. So typically, the amount that is canceled at the end of each year is about $40,000, and we're just asking that the language be amended to allow us to not cancel them every year, but they could automatically cancel at the end of the biennium or continue to roll forward.
Is that an either? I don't understand. That sounds like two different things. Either cancel or continue carry forward.
We would prefer them not to cancel every year and not to have to be manually canceled.
Uh-huh.
They could cancel at the end of each biennium. Would be a reasonable solution for us. If it was more amenable, we could also just be willing to allow the dollars to carry forward, and then that $40,000 they could pick up the next year and put back into the program.
So clear up the annual, but then figure out what we do on a biennial basis.
Okay.
So okay, we'll figure it out. Thanks.
And then, Mr. Chair, my last request is actually a request that we typically carry in both our bill as well as the public safety bill. It is for armor maintenance, and so because we typically we do the spending on this, and public safety gets the appropriation, we thought it was important to make sure that you saw it. Again, armor is the Allied Radio Matrix for emergency response, and this is an increase of $600,000 in 14 and 1,000, excuse me, a million in 2015. And this is primarily to go to cover the additional subscription services received through the agreement with Motorola that has been approved by the statewide board. 2 years ago, you may recall, we received an increase, but again, that is based on the growth of the system. And so we received an increase a couple of years ago, and we're very near the end of the build-out now at this point, and these additional services would be important.
So thank you, Ms. Hatter. I think this is the 800 megahertz system, members, that we heard a little bit about from DPS the other day. But it would be interesting. I mean, I think there's a lot of assumption what that is and what it is going to do when it's 100% build-out. So at some point we want to hear about that because a lot of new members and, I forget stuff. So what the vision was and is and will be. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, you're welcome. We'd be happy to come back and provide that for you.
Thank you. Or what was very helpful to us, and we just don't have the kind of narratives that we used to have in our budget books, which is, for the record, very annoying. MMB, I hope you're listening. But DPS brought in some nice one-sheeters on all the different program areas, that might get to some of what Senator Kiffmeyer's asking. If you have one-sheeters developed or maybe pull them out of the old system, that was really, really useful, the narratives around the program areas that help us understand what it is and what the measures of success are, et cetera. Can develop those. That would be a big help. Or just go back to the old system. That was our budget books were much, much more instructive back then. Thank you. Members, any questions for MnDOT? All right, well, we will definitely have a lot more discussion. We'll hopefully have more information about all this stuff that we kind of bookmarked that we want to know more about. But as we start getting into the construction of our budget for consideration by the committee and the full legislature, we'll have a lot more conversation. Oh, thank you. Yes, and we had these housekeeping items that we wanted to mention. So in your packets, members, are the map and directions to our seminar tomorrow. Keep in mind that the campus ramp parking is going to be validated by the Center for Transportation Studies. If you take a bus, let me know and I will pay for your fare myself. A couple of members have asked if anyone is driving there and back here to the Capitol, you know, so they would like a ride. So you guys want to just like match yourselves up either here or by email, or let Michael know and he'll coordinate you. There will be additional documents that we're going to be putting in the budget binders as they become available. If you take your binder with you, we'll stick it in your packet, and you can stick it in the binder yourself. Krista Boyd is has provided a spreadsheet. It just had the MnDOT and the Met Council numbers on it. I guess I should have said that beforehand. Public safety numbers are forthcoming. And also, all of our handouts are being scanned and posted online at the Scribd website, if you're folks familiar with Scribd, S-C-R-I-B-D. It's where you can post documents fairly easily. And we have a link to that. It's Transpo Public Safety. It's scribd.com at Transpo Public Safety. And we'll post them online so the public can see them ahead of time if folks are following us on TV. And then also if you want to access any handouts that there have been and you don't want to junk up your office with a bunch of paper, they'll always be out there for you to access. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All that is great information. I was also going to mention when you said put them in our binders, that they're not three-hole punched. I just end up with wads of it laying loose inside.
Okay.
So if it's convenient, if it happens to work for staff, sometimes they have these equipment things they do this real easy, but that helps us get them in our binders.
Okay.
So that is a
good,
nice idea.
Good suggestion. Or, yeah, we'll get pre-drilled paper and maybe make copies on that for stuff that you might want to stick in your binders. Because the MMB, actually Senator Tomasoni asked me if this were all the basic budget documents. I said, oh, no, we haven't added a couple of agents. Well, we have, because MMB is not giving us much anymore. That's why it's so skinny. So we have a lot of capacity to put a lot more stuff in these big binders. Anything else? Oh, you have the maps of location for both the ramp and then kind of where we'll be in the McNamara Alumni Center tomorrow night. So that'll help you out. And what else? And Michael will email these around to you if you don't want to take them with you. Great. All right. Anything else, members? We are adjourned. Thank you. We'll see you tomorrow night.